This is the Michael K. Show podcast.
I'm joyful and fun.
Listen live weekday afternoon starting at 2.
That's cool, man!
On 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, the TuneIn app, or on your smart speaker.
I'm really excited about this 30 for 30. We'll get a chance to see it later on in September where it'll be publicly released. But tonight, a special viewing in Central Park for the 30 for 30. Once upon a time in Flushing, about the 1986 Mets, one of the most infamous teams in the history of New York sports and certainly Major League Baseball. And the producer and director of the 30 for 30 is Nick Davidson. He joins us here on the Michael K. Show. It's Don LaGreca and Dan Grasso. Nick, how are you?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me. It's Once Upon a Time in Queens.
Queens, I'm sorry. What did I say? Flushing? Bad job.
Well, Flushing would have been terrific also, and Flushing has the wonderful double meaning. But, yeah, it's Queens.
Yeah, depending on what era of Mets baseball you're talking about. But certainly
exactly.
Want to get it right because I'm really excited about this because there's something about this team. And for people that weren't alive, and unfortunately a lot of our audience was not, I mean, this is 36 years ago that this happened. I mean, it's a long, long time ago since the Mets, you know, 35 years ago actually, going on 36 because this team is not going to win a championship this year. That infamous is the perfect name, Nick. It is, because I don't know if there were many people outside of the Met fan base that had any love for this team whatsoever.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I think one of the things that made this team so incredible, though, is how charismatic they were. And we talked to people on both sides. You know, one of our commentators says, like, love them or hate them. You kind of miss them now that they're gone because they were just a team of towering personalities and you know, you couldn't avoid them. Carter, Hernandez, Strawberry, Gooden were the stars. But then, you know, the so-called supporting cast, Lenny Dykstra, Mookie Wilson, Ray Knight, Ron Darling, these are fascinating characters. And a lot of people hated them, and they kind of reveled in being, you know, for one brief moment, the bad boys of baseball.
No doubt about that, Nick. And, you know, it's funny, too, because, look, that was one of my earliest baseball memories, the 86 Mets and that team. And certainly, you know, if you're a Met fan, you haven't had a heck of a lot to be proud about since 1986. So it's been a long time, you know, between celebrating those good moments there with the franchise. But I was really excited when I saw that this project was going to be a four-part series because, look, I remember a lot of things about that team. And there were so many memorable moments just in October alone. Forget about the entire season. But I guess the question I have is, how much additional stuff did you have to cut out just because you wanted to make sure you could fit it into four parts? How much wealth of info did you have in your hands?
So much material. The first rough cut, which I stand by, was 6.5 hours. And, wow. You know, we had to cut it down for television to 4 50-minute episodes. So it's 3 hours and 20. But I mean, there is so much material. And these guys finally, at this point in their lives, you know, they're in their late 50s and 60s. They don't care anymore. They're talking, you know, they're telling stories that they haven't told before, and they're not guarding their reputations or trying to look good or anything. So we really do tell the unexpurgated story of the rise and fall of this great team. And what was amazing about it is at the time, and this is where we begin, you know, watching that team come together after the sort of doldrums and misery of the late 70s Mets, you know, it was like piece by piece, they really put this team together the right way. Frank Cash and Joe McElvain and those guys really did it the right way. And they brought in, it's like a heist movie. They bring in the safecracker and the getaway driver and the cat burglar. And it's like each of these charismas comes on and you realize like you're forming not just a great baseball team, but a great team of individual personalities. It's a great story.
You know, Nick, a turning point for me is somebody that watched every game that year, and he contributed certainly to the run, was replacing George Foster with Lee Mazzilli. And in so many ways, because Lee had been a part of those awful Met teams in the 70s, and George was that big acquisition that never seemed to work out. Does that come up at all in this documentary, what Maz meant when he came here in the middle of the season?
Oh, very much so. And it's not just Mav coming, but it's Foster's departure, which, as you may recall, was not without controversy. You know, Foster was the first great acquisition of the Frank Cashin era. It didn't work out, but it was a signal to the fans and the rest of baseball, like, hey, this team means business. You know, we're not messing around. We're giving this guy a big contract. And then they started building, and they got Strawberry and Hernandez and Gooden and Carter, and they had a really solid team. And in 86, you know, Foster just wasn't hitting, and they had a lot of other options, so they put him on the bench. And he misspoke, really, and tried to sort of point out that perhaps, and he used the word racism. He said it is not a racist thing, but I wonder if maybe that's playing a role. And that was it. It was the third rail. You cannot use that word. You couldn't use that word in American sports in 1986. And before he knew it, he'd been released. And Mazzilli, who had been dropped by the Pirates, was brought back. And he was a conquering hero because he'd been kind of the lone bright spot. I know many Met fans still, you know, dispute the MVP of the 1979 All-Star game, feeling that Mazzilli was robbed by Dave Parker. He was the bright spot during the misery of the late 70s and then had been traded for, among others, Ron Darling. So bringing him back was like a perfect moment. And Foster was just shunted aside and forgotten.
And as you know, it's funny, late 70s as a Met fan, those are the things that preoccupied you. The only thing you had to look forward to, maybe winning an MVP in an All-Star game, because the real games certainly weren't bringing you any sort of satisfaction or joy there. I'm curious, no. Nick, and we're talking with Nick Davis. He's the producer and director of Once Upon a Time in Queens, four-part documentary series on those 86 Mets. Obviously, Gary Carter, you know, not part of this because he's since passed, and it's, you know, tragic. You know, that was my favorite player on that team, my favorite player growing up. But were there any other personalities, players, coaches, you name it, that you tried to get to talk, tried to set up an interview, and you just couldn't track down that weren't going to be featured in this?
You know, to be honest, not really. I mean, we did get Sandy Carter, Gary's widow, and she was terrific. We got all of the main players. We got a lot of the so-called supporting players. You know, we had an issue with COVID. I mean, I think everybody knows producing in the age of COVID is a challenge. So, you know, we would be zooming in from New York and you know, Lenny's in Southern California, or we had Billy Bean, who was a Met farmhand and kind of a scrub on the 84 and 85 teams. We interviewed him in Northern California, Kevin Mitchell in Southern California, Calvin Schiraldi in Texas, Ray Knight in Georgia. You know, there were a lot of sort of Zooms that we did. Terrific looking interviews, hired local crews, and the interviews are great. But really, there was nobody we really wanted to get and didn't get. I think because these guys all feel like, all right, it's time. I'm happy to tell this story. You know, I think there's been a lot of water under the bridge, and a lot of stories have come out about this team, and a lot of infighting and you know, nastiness, especially in the last few years. But I think at the end of the day, they all realize like this was a special moment for them, and they're happy to be part of telling the story.
Thanks for listening to the Michael K. Show podcast.
Well, that's awesome.
Looking for more access to the show?
That's right, man.
Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TMKS ESPN.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
And the shame of that era, you know, with the drugs and everything associated with that, really robbed, I think, a chance for there to be a dynasty, right? The injuries piled up, Doc in rehab in 87, you know, the loss to the Dodgers in 88. If there had been a wild card, there seems to be a lot of what ifs around this 86 team beyond what they could have been.
Yes, there are a lot of what ifs. And it's funny, as a Mets fan, I went into this project feeling like, oh, God, these guys, they should have won, you know, they certainly should have won in 88. And frankly, they should have won in 87. And 90, I mean, what happened in 90? You know, we sort of, you know, get frustrated and stuff. But actually, when you delve into the story and you realize the way these guys were living and partying, it's not, you know, it's not horrible that they didn't win more. It's a miracle that they won one. You know, it's like they at least we had the one. You know, I mean, can you imagine if they hadn't won? You know, we certainly wouldn't be making this film. It would have been a very, very different story. But, you know, at the end of the day, these guys all won a World Series in New York City, which is, by the way, in its roots, a National League town.
Yeah.
And that means something. And it means something to all of them. And I think that I hope that, you know, viewers who watch the film will come away feeling like, wow, that's really special.
And I can't wait for it because this was so much fun because, full disclosure, Met and Giant fan. So 86 was really, really special for me. And it all started with that Met team winning the first championship I ever saw that I remember in my lifetime. And then I find out, Nick, that my voice can be heard in episode 4. So I'm really blown away.
Yes, yes. I have to say, one of our assistant editors, we were looking for like the voice of a Met fan to complain about the Wilpon era. And we just didn't have it. And one of the assistant editors was like, dude, you got to listen to some of LaGreca's rants. And I listened to it.
Great ball!
Like, going right in.
Well, you had me at hello, so, and now you definitely have me after this. Once Upon a Time in Queens debuts on September 14th and 15th, 8 p.m. on ESPN. Special showing in Central Park tonight. Peter Rosenberg's going to be DJing, so looking forward to that. Nick, thanks. Best of luck with this, and I can't wait to watch it.
Thank you so much. I hope everybody enjoys it.
All right.
Thanks,
and
Nick.
Because of Nick and because of the 30 for 30, I will have a special top five involving the 86 Mets coming up next, Dan. So I know you're going to be on top of this.
Absolutely. I'm just looking at the poster, the promotional poster that Yes has been showing here. That looks pretty darn. I'd love to get a copy of that. And, you know, you frame that and put that on the wall there. That is a really nice, it's like an illustration. You know, the other thing, too, is you think about it, like, you know, when we look back at that era and you say, oh, boy, they only won just one. Think about maybe their chances would have been a little bit increased if you had a wild card back then, too. Right, Don? Because they would have made the playoffs a couple of times as a wild card. And then once you get in, who knows?
You never know. And that team certainly had the, you know, a pedigree of coming from behind and all that. And the Socia home run was killer in 88. Otherwise, I think they beat the Dodgers and beat the A's and win a second championship in 3 years. All the A's would have been tough, but since the Dodgers took care of them so easily. And just off the top of my head, you brought up Gary Carter. The only other ones that I think that were just a major contributors in 86 that are no longer with us would be Frank Cashin, the general manager of the team, and Bill Robinson, who was the first base coach.
Right.
Those are the only ones, I think, that have passed on. I don't think anybody that was on the roster, and obviously there could have been people from behind the scenes or whatever, but of at least people on the field and directly involved with the team, I think those are the only three that we lost from 35 years ago.
I think you're pretty much right. I know that you know, Buddy Harrelson's not doing very well right now. He's battling, I think it's Alzheimer's. Correct me if I'm wrong, but
he's been put in a home, an assistant living home.
Yeah.
He was the third base coach.
Third base coach. And, you know, that viral video of Ray Knight coming home to score the winning run in game six. You see Buddy, like, following him right down the line, waving him in. And, yeah, I mean, you know, it's – I remember I was at Citi Field five years ago when they did the 30th anniversary and they brought them all back and they had the reunion and that was special. And when you just said it to him, I mean 35 years, it seems like it was yesterday, but it's just amazing how fast time flies.
And the other thing that I think is so underrated about that team is, you know, the platooning. You know, a great team won 108 games during the regular season, a platoon at second between Tuffel and Backman, a platoon at third between Ray Knight and Howard Johnson. You had a platoon in center with Dykstra and Wilson.
Correct.
Right. And so they were platooning all over the place. So you had major, like, you had guys that were not starters that contributed, like Kevin Mitchell, you know, who was a role player, a young Dave Magadan on that team, who didn't get a chance to play because he was landlocked by Keith Hernandez. I mean, there's so many. Ed Hearn had a major contribution during the course of the regular season, even though he didn't get a chance to play in the postseason, backing up Gary Carter. And then parlaying that into getting David Cone during the offseason. How about that trade with Kansas City, which was phenomenal by Frank.
And Kevin McReynolds. I mean, I know McReynolds didn't fit New York. He didn't like it here, and he got a hard time. But McReynolds was a damn good player for them in 87 and 88. You know, he finished, what, in the top three in MVP in 88. You know, he was the left fielder starting in 87. So,
yeah,
you know, they
Kevin
almost
Mitchell.
Up. Right, for Kevin Mitchell. They almost, yeah. like, upgraded the personnel with the team over the next couple of years, but yet didn't have anything to show for it.
Thanks for listening to the Michael K. Show podcast. Hear more of Michael, Don, and Peter live weekday afternoons starting at 2 on 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, the TuneIn app, or on your smart speaker.